Came First, the musical The Misery. Hello there, and welcome to the latest edition of Big Mouth, the pop culture talk show for the modern time waster. Every week we talk about what really matters in the worlds of music, TV, film, books, comics, technology, and whatever else we fancy. My name is Andrew Harrison, and as usual, we have two special guests joining me here in the Big Mouth Wizard's Yurt. Smash Hits veteran Sean Pattenden returns to the Big Mouth Bunker for the second time. A seasoned pop writer in the glory days of The Hits, she's also on the slightly less glorious days of Slang Magazine. Sean is also a writer and illustrator of children's books and a book called How to Make It in the Music Business. She also runs the pop-up pop art and Hello, Sean. Glad
Hello.
To have you back.
Thank you.
How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
How does one make it in the music business? Can you walk into two sentences, please?
I think you probably... I've got no idea how you make it in the music business. That book is so old. I think you just... What I was going to say is you just close your eyes and you jump.
Yes.
And I think that's the best idea.
So, like Olympic diving, basically.
Yeah, but make sure you look good.
Ah,
yeah, yes.
Like Olympic diving, basically.
No, their shorts are too short in Olympic
right.
diving. Have bigger shorts and close your eyes.
Mm-hmm. Also joining us today is a Big Mouth regular, the Lester Bangs of Ballymena. It's Eamon Ford. Eamon is the most powerful music business writer in Britain whose word can make or break companies. He also writes about pop. He's shaking his head vigorously here. He also writes about pop music and general stuff for The Guardian and The Big Issue, for whom he lately interviewed his great showbiz pals Ricky Gervais and Kelsey Grammer. Eamon recently realised a lifetime ambition by getting something in the Viz comic Profanosaurus. Hello, Eamon. Can you please tell the listeners what you got in the Profanosaurus?
Yes, this was a huge, huge triumph. I took a picture of all those terrible Lynx body sprays that you get in a supermarket, and I described it as a Saks Past buffet. And Viz very nicely contacted me off Twitter and said, can we please put this in the Profanosaurus? And I said, you would make my life if you did that.
There
and it's
go.
In the current issue.
I am jealous because I've sent entries into the Profanosaurus so many times and not yet got anything in, so I doff my hat to you, sir.
I've peaked.
When I was a kid, we got a letter in Viz once, and it was something along the lines of, what are we going to call Prince Charles when the Queen dies and ascends to the throne? When we refer to the King, we inevitably mean the late pop singer Elvis Presley, so we should stick with the Queen, Queen Charles. What do other readers think? And they printed it. I'm pleased with that. You just heard him there, also with us, as he is every week, rounding out Team Big Mouth, ensuring that our sound is crystal clear and perfect. It's the Kanye West to my tune. Greeting Kim Kardashian. It's Matt Hall. Hello, Matt. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. I've been designing shapeless boots for Nike and charging £300 for them.
Fantastic. I'm sure we can sell them through our very own website. Okay, let's get going with some proper music. This year's Mercury Prize ceremony takes place on Thursday, the 15th of September. And this year, to the amazement of one and all, it has shaped up to be quite a good shortlist. Among the 12 nominees are albums by Bat for Lashes, the 1975, Kano, Savages, Sausages, Anoni, the artist formerly known as Anthony the Johnsons, and I'm not sure how you pronounce that, and also Radiohead and Michael Kiwanuka. The biggest and most poignant of all these, of course, is the nomination of David Bowie for his final album, Black Star. Who do we fancy? Where are we going to be putting our imaginary tenors? We're going to go through the runners and riders in a minute, but first, here is a track from one nominee. From the album Made in the Manor, here is Kano with T-shirt weather on the manor.
Nothing like it. 05 shit.
All Massive and Crew, that was Kano with T-shirt weather on the manor, one of this year's Mercury Prize nominees. Sean Pattenden, you're well known on the hardcore grime scene. What did you make of Kano?
I really like Kano.
Yeah?
I think Kano is great-o. Yeah. He's all right.
It's O-Kano.
Oh, that's better. Yeah. Yeah, I thought it was really good. I think the problem with the Mercury Award is it can be a little bit polite.
Yes.
And I think this year it's quite polite and it's a little bit Bowden and it's a little bit stripy and we're going to go on the beach and everybody's happy. Except I was obviously deeply unhappy. There's a lot of songs about how my wife left me for the gym instructor. And there's Kano just going, look, we went to McDonald's and then we had loads of champagne. Pain. It's like, great. I really liked it. I was getting into it.
It's interesting how music that supposedly speaks to the young people is much more interesting than music that's supposed to speak to people at your own age. We can talk, we'll go into the shortlist in a bit more detail shortly. But, you know, Eamon, the Mercury does have a reputation for being a little bit boring, doesn't it?
It does, but I guess that's its remit because it was set up against the kind of the showbiz and the razzmatazz of something like the Brits, which is all about commercial success.
Yeah.
And it's kind of one of those ones, it's damned if it does, and it's damned if it doesn't. If it picks really obscure artists, people just go, it's token, insert list of subgenres here. And if they pick somebody big and popular, they'll go, oh, you're just kind of playing to the gallery, and they can't really win. And I think this year, like every year, people will criticise, and rightly so, because it's just an awards thing. It's not like kind of the definitive take on popular culture in the last 12 months. But I think this year's I think they've kind of got a nice mix of the not too niche and the not too overtly commercial. Obviously, stuff like Bowie and Radiohead are kind of, it's effectively kind of outsider art, really.
Yeah.
But that sells a lot.
Well, the award, as well as having a reputation for being slightly boring, it has a terrible reputation for getting it wrong. And last week they were tweeting about the fact that M People won in 1994. And everybody said, that was the year that you didn't give it to Parklife or Jilted Generation by The Prodigy. You know, I would keep quiet about it if I were you. They seem to have been running away from the fact of, you know, like anybody, they can drop a clanger now and again.
Sometimes they capture the mood perfectly. I think, like, Franz Ferdinand or Arctic Monkeys are really good examples of kind of, these were bands that were kind of coming from the outside and were absolutely at the peak, and it kind of coincided because they were doing popular music that wasn't kind of crass in a way.
And pulp too, they got right with pulp.
I think that absolutely, to coin that very 90s term, it captured the zeitgeist.
Captured the zeitgeist.
While we're winding the motorways.
Do you think they were waiting for Kano to release an album which had a track featuring Damon Albarn on it before they made eligible for the Mercurys? I was reading a review of the De La Soul album, which we talked about the other week, and somebody made a rather pointed comment that, you know, it did have a track by featuring Damon Albarn on it, and I think this is...
He's the Father Damo. who creates that little bit of extra magic on your track and then goes out and smokes loads of cigarettes and plays football.
So it's the opposite of a parental guidance sticker, saying, you know, middle-class person guidance.
It's the Bowden sticker again. It's the Bowden. It's fine. You're getting a bit older. You can listen to it because Damon's on it.
Well, obviously, Bowie, as I just said, looms quite large over this list, and... as Eamon just said, you know, they're kind of damned if they do, damned if they don't. If he wins it, it'll be a scandal if he doesn't win it. People will say, well, what does David Bowie have to do to win a Mercury Prize? And if he does, everybody will say, well, you had to give it to him, didn't you?
I think his death, the repercussions of it are still being felt, and I think it would be a kind of beautiful way to end the year for him to win it. It would be a nice symbolic thing to say, like, here is a guy who 40 years more, 50 years into his career, was still doing really interesting albums.
Yeah, and it is actually quite a Mercury record, isn't it? It is art, jazz, weird noise.
Yeah, with kind of hunkin' jazz interludes and then basically a concept album about I'm about to die, and then he releases it and then he dies.
I know, that's fulfilling the marketing promise.
It'd be lovely to give to acknowledge his importance, and I think everybody does acknowledge his importance, but giving this prize to David Bowie, isn't that kind of like doing away with what the prize is supposed to be?
Well, no,
because it's the biggest amount of cash that you can get in a prize
how
in kind of music.
It's still 40.
Yeah, but also it's like it immediately sends the record kind of like straight to the top of the charts most of the time.
Most of the time, but
unless you're Speech to Bell.
Speech to Bell. But you know, he doesn't need the money. His estate doesn't need the money. He doesn't need the exposure. Whereas I think there's a lot more worthy artists on the list who would need
some kind of re-criteria. We say that if the album was a top 20 hit before the shortlist, then they're disqualified. If they want to be kind of niche, then they would need to, in this, almost like the opposite of the Brits have a criteria to say you have to have had a top 75 single or album in the period that we cover, to qualify. So maybe they should go the opposite way and go, if you haven't been in the top 40 in the last 12 months,
you're only eligible if you can prove that your album is horrible and nobody wants to listen to it, and then you'd be eligible. I think Black Star really makes the cut as a potential Mercury winner because it is capital A art music. It's somebody who kept changing up to the very, very last minute. He hadn't made any music like this previously. And I was reading a statistic the other day. I can't believe this is true, but is this the second biggest selling album of the year, or is it only on vinyl or something?
I think it's the second biggest selling album on vinyl, because I think, obviously, the Adele album's still selling, and then like Coldplay and whoever else will keep selling.
But, you know, quite a lot of people have brought Black Star, you know, brought us into their homes and had a terrible, terrible shock in a good way, which is what Mercury Music ought to do.
But I like the fact that it doesn't feel tokenistic, because obviously the narrative have changed a couple of days later when he died, and it's kind of become this kind of tombstone almost. But all the early reviews were going, this is an artist at the absolute peak of their powers.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't kind of retrospectively hailed as a classic. As soon as it came out, people were going, this is absolutely nuts and brilliant, and it's everything that Bowie is.
I wrote a few things myself around that time, and then, you know, and it's like, this is great. You know, who knows what we'll see from David Bowie next on Monday? Like, I think he might have actually already been dead when I'd found him.
I think it would have been crass if, like, it had been ignored, if it had come out and been ignored, and people went, it's just a bit rubbish. But people were, like, after the next day as well, people were going, he's absolutely back at the top of his game. He's done two brilliant albums back to back, having disappeared for a long, long time.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like the history's being rewritten.
Yeah, it was history being written.
Yes, yes it was.
Well, should we have a look at the rest of the list? Sean, did you listen to Anoni's Hopelessness, Anthony X. Johnson?
I did, and he was a bit, my wife has left me for a gym instructor. Mm. So there's this common theme in this.
Anthony Johnson's wife. Anthony Johnson's wife.
My wife and husband.
Yes.
Yes, I'm being broad here. Mm. I mean, Bowie's like, I'm dying. I mean, they've all got a bit of a problem here. There's an album to get out, but, you know, this is why. Yeah, I felt it was more of the same. It was a bit Anthony and the Johnsons. It was all right, but it was a bit depressing, wasn't it?
Well, it is a bit depressing. I thought it was actually a lot fuller and more, shall we say, I mean, I always found Anthony the Johnsons very monochrome and almost quite sort of eat you greensy. It was a bit sort of hard work Björk, made Björk sound commercial and enjoyable. Yeah. And this is more welcoming, there's more going on, it seems to be more musically vivid. His voice is still something you can take or leave,
That's the problem I have, is all these textures there, and it's, you know, it's a bit beautifully crafted, but the voice is a bit Hello Pub Singer. Fight with a cat, not sure.
Anoni appearing with Vic Reeves as in Pub Singer.
Yes, he's got that vow to him.
I'd love to hear Anoni doing Simply the Best with Vic.
Yes, he could do that sort of stuff.
Eamon, what do you make of Laura Mavoula and Anoni?
Well, I never ever liked Anoni and the Johnsons. It's the kind of the dictionary definition of not for me. I can't be bothered with that kind of overwrought nonsense. I'm sure he's a very important artist and all the rest of it, but on a listener level, I've just got not interested. Laura Mavoula, she's kind of one of those people that if it was on in the background in a cafe, I wouldn't object, but it's not something I would seek out. It's just kind of, it's there, and I get why she's good, but again, probably not for me.
Yeah, I have a problem with her voice as well. Sorry.
So I think there was a similar thing going on there, because for me, that was also, her first record was quite capital R, real music, real instrumentation, quite sort of, stripped down, and this is, it just seems to have a big shot of pop in it, really. Okay, it's not Carly Rae Jepsen, but it seems to be more, I hate to use the word vivid, but more vivid, more kind of, you know, more going on.
Yes, there's more going on, but sometimes I get that feeling when there's more going on, there's less. It's like, we're just going to make it so interesting and, you know, quite bleak and not too pop and yet, because what has it got to say underneath? Mm. You really just want sometimes to strip it back because there's so much.
Yeah.
There, it's just too.
Yeah.
I think the only one that I genuinely liked and had played a lot on that, on the shortlist, was Bat for Lashes, which is obviously a concept album about her about to get married and then her husband is killed on the way to the church. And I saw her perform it just before the album came out at the Union Chapel, which was just brilliant. And it made sense of the whole kind of night. And it was great that there's an idea behind it. And I always liked her anyway. So that's the one that I've kind of played the most. Radiohead, who I've kind of had a love-hate relationship with for years, because when they stopped writing songs, circa Kid A, I kind of got bored of them. But then when, what was the lead single? Burn the Witch, was it?
Yeah.
I thought that was amazing. And then the album came out, and then it was just all the dreary, wheely, I'm a bit existential.
I've lost my Oyster card.
Well, but see, I like that because, I mean, to me, they basically stopped writing songs with Kid A, as we know. But what they've been trying to develop since is just a way of getting feeling across that hasn't got verse and chorus and so on. And when it works on Moonshaped Pool, and it worked on In Rainbows, it's just very immediately I don't want to say visceral, because that makes you think you're experiencing something really frightening and painful.
Music.
But it's immediate. It makes you feel something instantaneous without ever being able to get your hooks into it.
See, that's what I think they can do, is they can do textures and they can layer upon layer without it sounding really painful and difficult and complicated and everything else.
Yeah.
You're getting something else from there, and it grows on you and it seeps in. And as much as I kind of hate the Radiohead idea, I really like that album.
Yeah.
I think you can listen to it again and again, and it just somehow... It works on a very not trying too hard level, and yet it must be incredibly difficult to make.
Yeah, so it's kind of swatches or kind of slices of feeling.
Yeah,
My feeling when I listened to it, because I was so excited about the lead single, going, my God, it's like the National Anthem or something like that. They've written a kind of weird oldie song that's quite poppy as well.
Yeah.
And then I listened to the album and went, and to quote that old cliche again, I went, oh, it looks like Radiohead have made their album again.
I think that's just a bit unfair, because when they did the previous one, King of Limbs, I thought really was dreary. I think it had no focus. And what was missing from it was an actual emotional punch, the way that I think this one's got it. And I think in Rainbows had it. In you expect Radiohead to be, oh, no, it's raining outside. Mm. Oh, no, playtime's cancelled again. And actually, these are very beautiful kind of thoughtful records that generate they just take you into a different mental space.
Having said that, I was at Primavera in Barcelona in whenever it was June, and they played there, and they obviously were leaning heavy on the new album, and it made a lot more sense kind of mixing with the other stuff.
Yeah.
And it felt a lot punch, obviously because it was live, but it just felt a lot punchier live. And they were jumping between, like, oh, then they would throw in like Paranoid Android or Creep or something like that. Mm-hmm. So there was enough to kind of momentum to keep you interested, but I just found the whole album after Burn the Witch is just kind of like, it was like flatlining for me. It was just going, it's the same song.
Now, there's kind of a curse on Paul Rudd Radiohead, isn't there? Because they get nominated every time they put an album out, they get nominated for the Mercury Prize, and either 9/11 happens, so they can't win it, or
but that gives them material for their next album about how the world is doomed.
Yeah, or you know, it's the year that they need to give it to Token Jazz, so Radiohead don't get it.
Yeah.
And this year, it's the year that David Bloody Bowie has gone and died on them. So you know, it just is they're doomed never to win one. Not that Radiohead really need 20 grand.
And does anyone need to win this award? I mean, really, does anyone need
do you know
to
who,
win
do you know
it?
Who I really want to win it?
Yeah,
who I really hope will win it. It's going to be The Comet Is Coming.
I quite liked it.
Do you know what? I was listening to it on Shuffle on the BBC. Have put together a really good playlist of BBC music, so with like four or five tracks from each of the things. And apart from the Kano and Skepta album, The Comet Is Coming was the ones that always stood out, but not stood out in a, oh my God, this is a really difficult jazz kind of way, but actually kind of like quite a good funk thing. And then I went to read a bit about them, and I want to see Jules Holland on the night that it's awarded announce that they've won and ask for King Shabaka, Danilog the Conqueror, and the Betamax Killer to come up and accept the award. Because that would be worth watching.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, I wrote down their names too. I think Danilog the Conqueror is amazing. I want to call myself Stanilog the Conqueror.
Stanilog.
I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? They're great.
Danilog and Betamax, I think we're sort of seeing an emergent thing there, aren't we? We can't go through every single one on the playlist, but there's on the shortlist rather. But let's have a quick listen to one of the more heavily fancied nominees. This is Michael Kiwanuka from his second album, Love and Hate. The first one was, I think we're possibly seeing an emerging theme here. People's first albums are stripped down and small, and their later ones are bigger and grander. This is Michael Kiwanuka with the bigger, grander Black Man in a White World.
I've been low, I've been high, I've been sold all my lies. I've got nothing.
I'm a black man in a white world.
Black Man in a White World. He's one of the favourites for this year's Mercury Prize, or at least the bookies are saying so. And we're talking about this year's nominees. What did we make of Michael Kiwanuka's album?
I haven't kind of engaged with it enough, as they say, in the market and world. It's kind of one of those albums that I'd kind of played and went, yeah, and kind of forgot that it was on while it was playing, and I probably should actually sit down and pay a bit more attention to it.
I
would be a terrible judge on the Mercury. It's kind of
right,
like whatever.
Not
but
for
like,
me.
Can we nominate Come On In My House Again by Sparks? That's my album of the year again.
Sean, Stanalog, did you ever listen to Michael Kiwanuka?
I did, and I thought it was very smooth. I thought it was very solid. I thought it was the good parts of Marvin Gaye. Actually, I quite liked it more than I thought it was going to be. I thought it was going to be really anodyne.
Yeah.
But there was some stuff in it, and I haven't listened to it enough, is what I thought. I'll actually have to go back and listen to it.
It has two really strong kind of lead tracks, and then I'm not sure how much kind of weight there is behind it. But the interesting thing, well, I was quite interested in that when watching The Get Down on Netflix, I think it's like the one modern track
that they actually
feature on the soundtrack.
There's a couple on that's spread through the series. I think he's actually had something to do with the making of it.
Right.
It seems to be more than just a guest track.
But I'm a Black Man in a White World is a fantastic
See, I was expecting, track. I thought he seems like a really nice bloke.
Yeah.
And, you know, good luck to him. I thought his first album was a little bit worthy and boring, and this isn't. This is bigger.
Yes, like, I was expecting a bit of Later with Jules Holland. I thought that's a screaming at me. It's and bit, no, there's far more depth to it.
It's Marvin Gaye, Pink Floyd, isn't it?
It's
lengthy, wild instrumental passages. And
his voice has something else to it. I did think that, you know, I was just expecting it to be smooth, but there's something else inside.
Of all of them was the one that I pressed the save button on the Spotify for and to take away, because I just thought that's a record that I think I can dive a little bit deeper into. Jamie Woon, did we have strong feelings about Jamie Woon's making time?
No, didn't bother with him.
Isn't he on there because like the XX haven't released an album and you know, other kind of artists who are very working maybe in a better way in this kind of area haven't, you know, they've contributed to Beyoncé's album and stuff like that, but they haven't actually put anything of their own out.
I just thought it was just Six Music Lighthouse Family. It was just kind of is this, and you know, I understand that they're kind of
the Six Music Lighthouse. What would that be? What would be the sound that they'd play out of the when the fog comes down?
It's the kind of thing that would appear as the BBC's next advert. You know, like the BBC doesn't do adverts except for its own stuff.
Yeah,
it would be a lighthouse and Lauren Laverne's in the top and running up and down with a crate of records. Oh, look, it's Jarvis Cocker, Steve Lomax rowing a boat in. Big pile of famous panda 7 inches, yo ho ho, kind of thing.
Need to make this ad.
Absolutely, yeah.
There's your creative, the BBC.
Absolutely.
The so-called mainstream media.
Yes, so-called MSM. Yeah, Jamie Woon. It didn't make an enormously powerful impression on me. But you know, we mentioned earlier, Kano, Made in the Manor, and also Skepta's Konnichiwa, with an actual hip hop grime death match. I think they're both great records. It's kind of annoying that they're on the list at the same time. You would have hoped that, you know, since Dizzy Rascal that was like 10 or 12 years ago, wasn't it? And Young Fathers won on the rap front, the hip hop front. We haven't really had an actual capital G grime winner.
But actually, it's quite good because normally there is the one token urban black album on the
token
list.
Token urban and token classical.
And this actually shows the strength of that kind of field of music in the UK at the moment, is that there's two that are possible winners, I think. You know, they're definitely
I guess a lot of their production tricks are the mainstream now.
Yeah.
It's like it's pop music has absorbed all of this stuff. So this is the kind of the bedrock of the top 40 in many ways.
But doing it without kind of and you know, the things like Dizzy Rascal didn't pander to the mainstream at all. But certainly the way that they do it, when you listen to it, it's kind of like full on.
Yeah,
the lyrics, the grime, music, the beds, it's great. You know,
the Skepta record is the more Frighten the Horses record, isn't it? A little bit more extreme, less adorned, shall we say. Kano's got, you know, there's more musical event on the go.
Yeah, but in terms of the lyrical content, the Kano one's just as much there of, you know, in terms of kind of the aggression and the kind of vibes.
I suppose it does look out there and insane if you're a 40-something academic or a critic like us, but if you're 19, this is, as Eamon says, this is what you're listening to all the time. Yeah. This is the mainstream.
Well, is it the new Bangers track? That is an insane record. There's no
like
chorus.
A metal rave record.
It's kind of like, you know, it's just him kind of ranting for like 4.5 minutes. Yeah. No instrumental break, nothing.
I did spot hidden, nestled in amongst the Kano record, there's the Art of Noise. Hey, you know that?
Yes.
Hey, and when the Prodigy put that on Firestarter, they had to give a writing credit to the whole of the Art of Noise and pay a massive chunk of money to the Art of Noise, which meant that Paul Morley made a load of cash out of Firestarter. Is poor old Kano going to have to write a massive Gregory to the Art of Noise and Dudley Trevor Horn?
Yeah,
Paul
Morley.
The last few things we haven't talked about on the Mercury shortlist: Savages, Sausages, Adore Life, The Modern Susie and the Banshees. What do we think, Sean?
Not for me.
You like the old Susie and the Banshees, don't you?
No, I do not.
Don't you?
No,
why not?
I'm not some old goth.
You don't have to be an old goth to like Susie and the Banshees. I'm not.
I was too young to know their punk years, so I knew them when they were old goths.
Okay. All right. Eamon, what do you think of Sausages?
I love Sausages because but not for the reasons that they perhaps
because they bought Banger's house.
Do you remember? remember in the in Melody Maker, they used to do this piss take letter every week called "It Was Diary of a Mannix Fan," where everything was intensely intense.
Yes,
and how they basically had fallen into the cult of Richie and kind of go, I'm feeling so intense, and that's them. They're like intensely intense. Well, they're just, I can't take them seriously.
I'd say they're not the new Susie and the Banshees. They're the kind of new au pairs. They're a bit more intense and they don't have that kind of sense of humour that the Banshees
have. My Banshees are renowned for their sense of humour.
I think they've got a
sense of humour. I once described them on Twitter as Joyce Division.
Oh, very good.
But that fell flat.
The only one.
better written down.
I think, having said that, we're not going to go through the entire list. It looks like we actually have. The only record we haven't mentioned is the 1975's portentously titled "I Like It When You Sleep, For You Are So Beautiful, Yet So Unaware of It."
Unexcess.
Yeah.
Don't get it. I mean, I was looking forward to listening to it because a friend of the podcast, Michael Hann, the radio show, Michael Hann, loves the 1975, and I've never got around to listening to them. And I was listening to this, and I just, apart from the fact that it sounds like it was made in kind of 1987, which is quite fun to spot the influence and spot the kind of production technique, I just don't understand it at all.
But I think, I mean, they are massively popular with the young people.
Like if they're doing like a couple of nights at the O2 in December, they're huge.
Yeah. What do you think of them, Stan?
They leave me cold. Mm. I just don't get it. And it's the Matt Healy. It's just stop. You look like Brian Molko. Please, Jess, put it away. I just think put it away.
Raised Brian Molko. Can I? My favourite freeze of the entire year was when Sylvia Patterson was doing press for her wonderful book.
Fantastic book.
And somebody asked her about if she ever tried to kind of bury an artist. She said, only one, but she didn't want to give them the publicity. And he said, no, who was it? And he said, it was Brian Molko. And she described him as a slippery goblin of a man. That's my go-to insult now, you slippery goblin of a man.
Poor Brian Molko. Yeah. The 1975. Well, I think that, you know, we are the old people. And, you know, my nieces are all over the 1975. I think they're the greatest thing ever. I think it's good that, you know, they can have bands that we don't understand because we're old and we're stupid.
Are we going to let them? We're going to allow them?
We're going to allow them.
Or should we not? Should we take their records away from them?
Yes, pop star.
You're on the naughty pop stand.
So looking through it then, who do we fancy? I mean, wrong, but it looked like there was a stronger set of female artists on this one than perhaps there usually is. Who do we fancy? I'm going for Kano, and with an outsider maybe on Michael Kiwanuka. That's why I'm putting my tenor. If it's not Bowie.
Oh, well, is Bowie excluded?
Well, I think, you know.
Are they going to have a bunk award? So they have, like, the normal award and then the Diva Bowie. He gets top bunk because that's best.
That wouldn't surprise me if they do a special kind of Bowie and then.
Yeah.
Maybe.
But who do we honestly think is going to win it? Forgetting the fact that Bowie has got special Bowie privileges.
I can never call it. I'm always wrong, but I quite like Kano to win it.
Okay. I think Kano would be a really good choice. In terms of the album I played the most, be Back for Lashes, but that's just that says more about me than it does about the award. But I think Kano would be a real kind of statement thing as well, because it doesn't feel tokenistic. It feels that here is an artist who is really shaping the mainstream, coming from the outside, and effectively doing what Bowie was doing in 1972. Like, he's coming from the outside, and the kind of music that he's working in is completely redefining the pop mainstream.
Matt, who are you going for?
Kano with the comet is coming as a kind of like really mad thing to happen.
Well, we'll see.
If they all lose their collective minds.
Can we edit this out if we're all wrong?
Let's just go through all the artists and go.
I think the winner will be
like one of those sort of automated phone lines. Yes. Hello, Andrew, you have won £1 million. Right. So apart from Fancy and Bowie for it, we think Kano is a goer. Mm. That's enough music for a minute. Let's move from one gladiatorial contest to another. Every summer, Amazon Instant Video choose their new on-demand series by the novel method of letting people watch them and then vote for them, or rather give their opinions on them. This is what brought us Transparent and The Man in the High Castle. This year, there are three series up for the vote. There is the very odd and ironic Jean-Claude Van Johnson, in which Jean-Claude Van Damme makes a comeback both as a corny action hero and an actual undercover agent. There is I Love Dick, a very dry relationships comedy about a New York filmmaker. I'll say that again. I Love Dick, a very dry relationships comedy about a New York filmmaker and her obsession with an art professor, played by Kevin Bacon. And there is The Tick, a live-action superhero spoof comedy starring Peter Serafinowicz. What did we like and what did we hate? Before we talk about it, let's have a quick listen to The Tick.
Oh, I'm not going crazy. I'm not going crazy.
You're not going crazy, Arthur. You're going sane in a crazy world.
Oh, God!
Oh, nice bed. Thanks for turning off that beeping.
You're real?
Don't get stuck on trivia, man. We got a tiger by the tail. So this is your HQ, huh?
No, this is my apartment.
This your secret trigger?
Don't touch anything.
Whoa, check out the crime lab. It's all thorough and complicated. You've got ideas, theories. I like that in a sidekick.
Sidekick? Who's saying anything about sidekick?
Don't Perfect. Touch this. You got the brains. I got the everything else. Come on, man. Don't you feel it? We're part of a plan that's bigger than the both of us.
What are you talking about?
I'm a superhero, Arthur. I'm nigh invulnerable. I have the reflexes of an Olympic-level jungle cat. I have the strength of 10, perhaps 20 men. A crowded bus stop of men. But my greatest power is this. When destiny speaks, she speaks to me. She says hi, by the way. And she wanted me to give you this.
Don't slam. What is this?
Everything that survived last night's explosion.
Explosion? Tick, did you attack that gang?
Huh. I broke a few eggs, but the omelet is huge.
Listen, Tick, look, I'm sorry, but I am not part of any sort of bigger plan that you have going on here, okay? I'm trying to prove that the terror's alive, and that's it.
You're gonna have to do more than just prove it.
That was Peter Serafinowicz as The Tick from Amazon's pilot season. We're talking about Amazon TV's punts for this year with our special guests Sean Pattenden and Eamon Ford. Eamon, you like Peter Serafinowicz. What did you make of The Tick?
I would say I kind of quite like him, but then sometimes he just feels a bit overbearing. It just feels a bit too forced sometimes. And I think he's obviously incredibly talented and very kind of witty and sharp and brilliant at loads of different voices. Like, I don't know if you saw that YouTube clip where he invents loads of characters. He does like 40 impressions in 3 minutes, and it's just all characters he's made up. Yeah. And he does them back to back, and that's really clever. But this, you're kind of wondering, like, he's actually presented as the superhero of this, and I don't think he's convincing as that, but I'm wondering how the next few episodes will play out, because he's not like a klutzy rubbish superhero from the few action sequences that he's in that kind of that trailer, well, kind of pilot, I guess.
Yeah.
Is like he seems to be quite good at being a superhero.
He's super strong, and he's wearing
a kind of big kind of padded suit, so he doesn't have to work out. But I don't know. I don't know if maybe they'll kind of play a bit more on the neuroses or stuff like that in the later episodes. I don't know, but it just felt hard to kind of get your teeth into.
Well, the setup of the show is that it's kind of all seen through the eyes of Arthur, who is a guy who in his youth saw his dad killed in front of him by a bunch of by a supervillain.
Yes.
And it's kind of marked him. And yet this is a comedy, and we're not entirely sure whether the Tick, who is a big, blue, you know, parodically muscular, hilariously square-jawed superhero, we're not really sure if he's real or if he's just in Arthur's head. This is the third version of the Tick. It was originally a cartoon, and the same guy who created it, Ben Edlund, who is also, he's written scripts for Firefly, Gotham, Angel, Supernatural, things like that. The creator is behind all of these versions. There was a previous live-action version which wasn't particularly successful, and now this Amazon version. And, you know, to me, I've sort of like semi-followed it. It's great if you're a comics person, but I'm also thinking that now that the whole world has been steeped in comics, we've all seen The Avengers and we've all seen, you know, Batman, Superman, all that shit, are we open to the kind of spoofing and the mockery of the superhero genre? Sean, what were your feelings about The Tick?
I found it confusing because I don't think it knew whether it was going to be comedy or it was going to go down the superhero line.
Yes.
I think it felt as sort of ambiguous as the Tick character is,
yes,
where you don't really know if he is super or not. And he sort of just, it verbally wanders around and you're just not sure if he has the powers or not. I get that. I think he's a figment of the imagination.
Yeah.
Of the main character, but I just think, and I really like Peter Serafinovich as well. I think he's really, really funny, but I was just left feeling I just don't know what this is by the end of it. I'm not sure what it's trying to do and how it's trying to play it.
There's
is
also
it
a slight, I mean, as Eamon said, that, you know, he's great at voices, but there was this really disconcerting thing in the voiceover at the start of the pilot episode where for 1 minute you hear Serafinovich's version of Terry Wogan. and all of a sudden it just threw me back to that, which I still think is kind of one of his best ever things that he's done, which is Wogan emceeing over a jungle with a T-Wog.
Yeah.
and it was just after that it was kind of like, oh, I can't
really. I like
really.
The idea of Super Wogan. I mean, to me, you know, the original cartoon version is a lot weirder, and it's like a spoof of the entire idea of superheroes. So their equivalent of Batman is called Defleedermouse, and the villains are called, you know, there's Chairface Chippendale, who's actually got a chair for a head. And this obviously can't be quite as weird as that, but I mean, this is the one that I enjoyed most. This is the one that I think I would vote for. What about I Love Dick, which is an adaptation of the, of the cult feminist novel by Chris Krauss. In the TV version, an artsy New York couple played by Griffin Dunne and Catherine Hahn move to the bohemian western town of Marfa, and they both become fascinated by a cowboy intellectual played by Kevin Bacon. Their marriage comes under the inevitable strain. Sean, what did you think of this?
The problem I had with this,
yes.
and well done, everyone made it, and, you know, I hate doing this criticism thing sometimes because, like, people had a real go. They had a real go at trying to do this, and now I'm going, I didn't really like it. The problem I had is that Kevin Bacon being so hot that just everybody falls for him.
Yeah.
Well, he's quirky and he's odd, but he's short and he's Kevin Bacon. And I just don't get that. He just didn't do the sex god thing at me enough for me to get the fact everyone was falling over themselves via his intellect and his hunkin' body.
Yes.
That's what I didn't get.
Yeah.
And it's about this woman fancying this man. Okay. So what it's about. There weren't enough supporting characters. There was no other stories, it seemed.
The implication, I think, in the book, we don't know if the TV show is going to follow the same route, is that the husband also becomes infatuated. And so an addition to the
That's
grand
canon. That's what I mean.
You're getting that idea from
them.
Yeah.
I quite liked it because I thought maybe I was kind of imposed my own reading on it, but I thought it was kind of going to go a bit kind of Jonestown, a bit he's going to create this massive cult because there is the whole thing, like as you say, like all these people fall in love with this guy and they're completely obsessed. And I think is he running some sort of writer's retreat or something? Yeah. Is that the kind of premise is why they're there? And the wife isn't technically supposed to go there, be there, because she's supposed to be in France for some... Venice for some film thing. And it almost felt like it was like, take these people, maybe it's some kind of riff on Scientology or some kind of cult Manson thing or something like that. And I thought you could do something really interesting with that. Like, you've taken these people into a kind of a hick town and... you've taken away from their kind of their middle class safety net.
Yeah.
And what will happen if you turn them into a proper cult?
Well, the gist of it is that partly because, you know, this is the kind of bedrock of the novel, and also the show is kind of framed in all this monologue from the lead character, Chris. It's very much like it is the TV show of the female gaze. The camera's lingering on, you know, how hunky Kevin Bacon is. It's all about her, you know, churning power of...
He's sizzling
bacon, absolutely, yes.
Well, I really like the... I've got to say, I'm was unsure about the actual kind of content of it, but I really like the look of it and the style of it, and it reminded me very much of those kind of late 80s American indie films, you know, down to the kind of fact that there's the captions come on the middle of the screen, cut to red and captions on the middle of the screen, and then people talking to camera and kind of cut shots.
Strange
and
cuts,
stuff, and also the fact that it's in the middle of this kind of like weird desert town, you know, it looks very... kind of grainy.
It does look
great.
And, I just couldn't get past the fact that they were just such insufferable bores.
But aren't they supposed to be? Aren't they supposed to be ghastly people?
I'm not sure of the appeal of wanting to watch ghastly people behaving in a ghastly manner.
Wanted to watch ghastly people, I would look in a mirror.
Ah, there we go. Yes, it was. Yeah, the idea of going to a writer's retreat full of bourgeois bores hardly seems like hashtag relatable content. The producer, the director, rather, Jill Solway, also produced Transparent and Six Feet Under, and so it's part of a body of work, I suppose. What do we make of Jean-Claude Van Johnson? That's a proper real man, red meat TV.
I really loved this.
Yes.
I thought this was brilliant.
Give the listeners the premise.
The premise is, it's Jean-Claude Van Damme in his when he goes around making kind of crappy 80s. Action movies, he's actually also working as a kind of hitman come super spy whose real name is Johnson. And obviously it was
Johnson Dick. What's
well
going
I did
with
think that well, was very strange. I did think that they were kind of obsessed with, you know.
Yeah.
But the gag is he's kind of washed up as an actor because he's retired. He's also because he can't get any roles, and he's also washed up as a super hitman, sort of super spy. And there's just a lot of a lot of good gags.
I have to hold my hand up and say I didn't do my homework and watch this one, but it sounds a little bit like It's Bind and Dine. Have you seen that?
Yeah, it's very much like that.
I used to be really good, but now my kind of great life has fallen apart.
You kind of also think that the show people looked at those Coors ads for the beer and thought he's quite happy with taking the piss out of himself.
Huge credit to him because he has a reputation for not being the easiest person to be on set with, and all credit to him for being willing to take the piss out of himself. The beginning opening scenes are really sad. He's rattling around inside his Malibu mansion, bored and lonely.
When he opens the cupboard and they've got all the saved
the Pop-Tarts.
Which he then microwaves.
He has his own logo on his shampoo and his aftershave and all the things.
And the most exciting thing in his day is he takes a segue to the end of the drive and picks up the paper with some tongs. Yeah, he picks up Variety. So he's willing. He really is quite abject in these
scenes. But we've seen this story before. This is a story of fame is rubbish because it turns you into someone who can only be self-reflexive, and then you get to be in a self-reflexive TV show or a self-reflexive film about yourself, and we all laugh because you can make fun of yourself. But what's underneath? There's nothing underneath. If you dig, it's a beer ad.
But also,
it's 30-minute beer ad.
Yeah, but there's also kind of like the bit where he goes to a dry ramen restaurant and orders these ramen, and they just come in a block.
That was quite
and he says, "Where's the water?" And the guy goes, the hipster kind of bearded hipster goes, "It's a pop-up experience. Yeah. We don't do water."
and then he thinks he's Val Kilmer.
Yeah.
To me, I liked the fact that it was willing to take the piss so much out of Hollywood. Every role that he's offered is an action reimagining of Anne of Green Gables.
From the woman who used to be in the Cosby Show.
He's
amazing. Yeah, I thought she was really good.
We've actually done a whole load of spoilers here, what I liked about it is the fact that it's done with obvious affection for Jean-Claude Van Damme, who thought there could be such a thing, and a nicely ironic view of what Hollywood's all about. And it made me think better of Jean-Claude Van Damme, and it made me think I would watch more episodes of this. So, out of all this stuff, what do we fancy? Obviously, I fancy The Tick because I'm a massive nerd. Sean, would you
I don't
watch
know.
Any...
I'm. I've got my head in my hands.
Fancy any of them. Okay.
I could say really. I like Dick.
What's the name of the show that you like, Eamon?
This is going to be edited out. When I die, it's going to be on a tannoy above my head. So I love Dick. I only like it if it goes down the mad cult route.
Okay.
Which is that's my projection onto it. So if it's not going to do that, I might.
Okay. And I'm up for Jean-Claude Van Johnson.
Okay, I'm up for The Tick, and I'm not up for I Love Dick. Not on your life. And on that bombshell, we've come to the end of the show, and that means closing time chatter, where we ask our guests for the idea or the story or the feature or the argument that's been burning a hole in their brain all week. Sean, I believe that Ken Campbell has been impinging himself on you this week.
As he does sometimes. Ken Campbell, who is a pretty much an all-round visionary theatre practitioner, amazing person, was in Brookside as well, and various other things, had a theory that you might wake up sometimes and have mystery bruises. Needless to say, he did drink quite a lot. But you know that thing of, I've got a bruise over there. He felt that was paranormal activity and would try and relate it to string theory and various other science things. I have been finding recently mystery notes on my notes app. Suddenly, in the middle of the night, when I've got really bad insomnia, I've been tapping stuff down, and I won't remember it until the next day. And I'm wondering if this is a thing, if other people have mystery notes, or this is aliens. Is this something else? Are we getting into a different dimension here? I was going to read some of my notes out. I really don't remember having put
these. These are the new crop circles.
Yeah. Bipolar bear. One of them.
That's actually a British Sea Power t-shirt.
Oh, is it?
With a polar bear on it. Bipolar bear.
I don't like them, so I wouldn't have seen that. So that's them getting to me. Yeah, okay. Ian Dorfin.
Ian Dorfin.
Yeah.
That's a Viz Comet character.
Yeah, that's punning in my sleep.
Wasn't he a character? Isn't he the lead singer of The Comet Is Coming?
Yeah, with Dan Lok. Sats Biscuit.
I like Sats Biscuit.
That's someone sending me a message. Then Billy Ocean records, 80s ones coming in. Get Out of My Dreams and Into My Car. I found that I've written that as well. And an Nespresso Depression, Men Can't Help Acting on Impulse. So this is messages. I am a conduit here.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm sure. And I want people to write on forums and your blog and stuff like that, if this happens to them as well. Because at the moment, I think I'm the only person, but I want notes at paranormal stuff, please.
And a friend of mine, who I'm not going to name, had been taking an illegal substance. Ooh. And in the night
that narrows it down a bit,
the meaning and the truth of reality came to him, and he thought, I'll write this down on a bit of paper so I don't forget it in the morning. So he wrote it down on a bit of paper, and he went upstairs and put it in the sock drawer and collapsed on the bed. And then the next day he woke up and said, where's the bit of paper? I need to, the truth, the meaning, the secret of everything is there. And he went to the sock drawer and he found a bit of paper, and on the bit of paper it said, everybody should be nice to each other. So that was the insight.
He wasn't wrong.
Yes. Eamon, your closing time chatter.
I'm very up to date with all of my stuff. I'm listening to stuff from a year ago. There's a great American podcast series called You Must Remember This, which is like the secret history of Hollywood, the first 100 years of Hollywood, which is great. And they've done, it's like a 12 or 13 part series called, it's called Charles Manson's Hollywood. So it's basically, it's about the Manson family and the Manson killers, but they spin off from that to kind of go into proper detail about all the different people that he was involved with or touched with. So it's like all of these different perspectives. So every episode's kind of self-contained. They'll do a little bit about him building up the cult, and then they'll have a whole episode about, and I've completely forgotten his name, but he was the producer for The Birds, Doris Day's son. So it's like how he had kind of got into
Terry someone, wasn't it?
Yeah. And like Dennis Wilson, there's a whole episode around Dennis Wilson. So it's all of these people linked to Manson, but then it's like explaining that context of Hollywood in the late 60s, and it's really fascinating. But it's a year old, so I'm only waiting for that. It's still available. It's brilliant.
In shops.
It's so good.
I'll see your year old and raise you, because I'm just started reading A Brief History of Seven Killings, which won the Booker Prize in 2015, and it's a brilliant account of Jamaica in the kind of early 70s, around the aggro and real senseless violence for the two political parties, and the way that that Bob Marley was kind of stuck in the middle of it and stuff. It's brilliant. It's really good.
Well, I have been enjoying, and it's coming out shortly, Simon Reynolds' Shock and Awe, which is his gigantic book about glam rock. It's really interesting. It runs obviously from the obvious things like Mark Bolan and Bowie through Alice Cooper right up to the present day. And what it made me realise really is that like glam was not an aberration or a one-off. It wasn't just a little, you know, thing at the early, in the beginning of the 70s that didn't matter at all. It's actually the natural order of things in pop. Pop ought to be weird and ridiculous and over the top. And it made me understand that the whole world of pop is actually a giant cosmic struggle between the forces of glam and the forces of boring real music. And it's cavaliers and roundheads all over again. It always will be. And I think we are overdue more glam and more cavaliers and more stupid haircuts and more platform boots. More of that.
Yes. Glam. Please. 24/7 for me, please.
Yes. So there we go. So that is another Big Mouth show in the can. Huge thanks to our special guests, the writer and art curator, Sean Pattendon. Hello again, Stan. Thank you for coming.
Thanks.
And Eamon Ford of The Guardian, The Big Issue and everything else. Don't forget that you can listen to this episode again at audioboom.com/channels/Big Mouth. You can subscribe, and please do, at iTunes. Go to the iTunes Music Store, go to the podcast section and just search for Big Mouth. And if you can find it in your heart to give us a star rating, a good high 5 out of 5, then that's good all round for us. You can follow our podcast and also our features at facebook.com/bigmouthuk. And we'll be back next week. In the meantime, have a splendid week. And just to finish off, here is a track by clearly the favourite for the Mercury Prize this year. This is probably the last song David Bowie will ever release from Black Star. It's called I Can't Give Anything Away.